All right, back on the record, June 4th, 2025, 2:40 p.m. on this overview appeals. We just finished testimony from direct testimony from Ms. Hyland and cross from Ms. Clunchan. I guess we're back to Mr. Schutz, correct, for cross. I believe, Mr. Wachter, you had an opportunity for cross, right?
I don't know that Mr. Walker has yet.
Oh, has he? Okay.
No, I believe I covered my ground. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Wachter. All right, Mr. Schutz, go ahead.
Just a couple questions. Sharing my screen. Is this the map you were referencing, Ms. Hyland?
Yes.
Okay. So there seemed to be a little bit of confusion. Is this the map that was pr produced with your report following all of the work on remand?
Correct.
Okay. And we looked at another one that showed the, I think it was at F18, page 42, and that showed the alternate kind of proposed wetland. And it looked like maybe that you had mentioned that maybe the polygon had shifted a little bit in that image of the, sort of proposed alternative wetland.
Mr. Schutz, sorry to interrupt. The map we're looking at right now, did you tell us the page number? It's F18, page 13,
Page
is it?
13.
Okay. Thank you.
So is that all accurate, Ms. Hyland?
Yes, I think the one that we looked at with Ms. Clungeon was the polygon was inadvertently shifted to the east a little bit by accident.
That's fine. And I just wanted to clarify that for the record. I think what had come up was this idea that that the applicant should have tested, between the Dr. Cook data plots SP 2, 3, 4, and 5, and the 355-foot wetland. And I just wanted to pull this up and ask, I mean, between SP3 and the 355 wetland, I mean, there's multiple test plots that have been dug between, isn't there?
Yes, we did. I mean, in October, I believe we added additional plots between SP3 and the wetland, and that includes DP23 and I think 26. And then in the other directions, we have additional data plots in between SP4 and 5 and the wetland, as well as between SP2 and the wetland. They were collected prior, but there is quite a few data plots between Dr. Cook's and our wetland boundary.
Okay, so it's like so some on this map, not everyone has a name attached to it, probably because there just wasn't space. Is that your understanding? Okay, but
Yes.
what you're talking about is these multiple data plots that are between Dr. Sarah Cook's data plots and the wetland. For example, between SP2, you have DP4, and it looks like DP21, maybe. With SP4, you have several there between, and with 5, again, several between. So there has been a lot of data collected in the area that Dr. Cook claims is wetland, between her data points and the 355 wetland. We're looking at just a number of dots, and they all show outside of that 355 that there's no wetland there, correct?
Correct.
Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Silent, thank you for your testimony. All right, Ms. Clunchan, and is Mr. Adams available yet?
Oh, sorry, I was muted. Yes, I believe Mr. Adams is available.
Okay, let's put him up then.
Okay, pull him over.
There he is. Okay, Mr. Adams, welcome back. I think you're almost done. Just have the cross-examination from Mr. Wachter and then redirect from Ms. Clunchan. So let me swear in real quick. Just raise your right hand. You swear firm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
I am.
Okay, great. All right. Mr. Wachter, any questions?
Yes, thank you. Hello, Mr. Adams. I'm Neil Wachter on behalf of Kitsap County. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Wachter.
Yeah, pleased to meet you. Sir, I was wondering, in preparation for your testimony in this hearing this week, did you have occasion to consult with any geologists or geotechnical experts regarding the subject property?
No.
And did you have occasion to, same question, but did you have occasion to consult with any structural engineers with reference to the subject property?
When you say, did I have occasion, you mean, did I? I did not. No. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm just asking again, you know, just in order to prepare for your testimony.
Yes, that you delivered. I did not consult with a structural engineer for this project.
Okay. Were you present to hear the testimony, or were you listening in on the testimony of Mr. Piosky? A couple days ago?
Only portions of it, and so you'll have to forgive me. I might not have heard all of it.
Okay. And how about the architect on behalf of the applicants, Mr. Miller?
Yes, I was listening to Mr. Miller's testimony.
And did I understand that you heard part but not all of the engineer's testimony, Mr. McCormick?
No, I heard all of Mr. McCormick. I believe I heard all of Mr. McCormick's testimony.
Okay. What is your understanding of the number of apartment units in each of the four proposed apartment buildings in this project?
There are approximately 40 units in each building.
And for each of those units, what's your understanding of the number of parking stalls that are to be provided at this point in the permitting, if you will?
I don't have that information.
Okay, but certainly you would expect it's at least one per apartment unit, if not more.
No, I wouldn't expect that. But I wouldn't be surprised if you told me that was the current agreed upon parking count.
Okay.
We certainly see projects that have far less than one stall per unit.
Okay, fair. You testified to the concept of a podium in sort of a building construction model. Is podium a term of art that's understood in your field?
Yes.
So forgive me if I ask you a basic question or two about that, but what exactly do you mean when you describe a podium?
In this case, it typically means a concrete structure. It usually has a different fire rating that the separation between the podium structure, again, which is typically made of concrete, allows for a lighter frame, often a wood frame building, to be constructed on top of it. There's advantages in terms of, in some municipalities and some areas where you can build a taller building, more storage than you would if it was a monolithic type of construction, all wood, for example.
Okay. And is it, I think at least one witness may have mentioned this idea that it's almost like two separate structures that you're looking at or that you're describing when you have a wood frame structure that's atop a podium. Is that a fair characterization?
I wouldn't use the, since we're trying to be deliberate with language, I wouldn't use the word structure because I don't want to be suggesting that one doesn't have a structural impact on the other. But the two constructions have, in many ways, can operate somewhat independently of each other.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you setting me straight, because it's distinctly possible that I'll use less precise language than you do. So
I doubt it, but
no, this is, you are the expert in one field for a reason.
Okay.
So I guess from a, did you hear the testimony? I believe it was offered by Mr. McCormick concerning seismic stability or building to meet seismic codes as obviously one of the considerations for any building design of this nature.
Yeah, we have to meet any kind of dynamic loading, which not only includes seismic, but includes wind, for example.
All right. And you certainly would agree with this statement that there has to be a way for the, in the instance of a wood frame structure, using that word, atop mm-hmm. a podium,
mm-hmm.
you would have to agree with the statement that the seismic, the design has to account for the current day seismic standards for the entirety of the project or for the entirety of the structure, right?
Yes, the seismic load of the wood frame structure onto the podium below would have to be considered.
So, are you familiar with the hearing examiner's previous decisions in this matter? Have you read them?
I'm going to say I haven't read them recently.
Okay.
So you have to remind me.
Are you familiar with at least familiar in a general sense with what the hearing examiner has ruled to date?
Yes, to the best of my ability to understand some of your language in there, the legal language, I should say. Excuse me.
Is it and are you aware that the hearing examiner had previously found that there was an artesian aquifer that underlies this building site?
Yes.
Yeah. What is your personal experience with designing multi-story buildings above an aquifer that's very close to the Earth's surface?
The only experience that I can directly point to is when we were building the building against Salmon Bay, and we were over that water table there. We had similar concerns.
Were there any issues? Was underground parking an issue with that particular structure?
Yes, in part because not only did we have the problem of the potentially finding ourselves dropping the building into Salmon Bay unexpectedly if we didn't maintain appropriate lens of soil, but we also had a considerable amount of contamination from the marine shipyard that had previously been on the site that would have been released into the waterway.
So
shallow foundations were extremely critical, but we needed to provide parking was also an extremely difficult situation for land use code reasons that I don't want to bore everybody with here, but we had to find a way to get the parking to make the building work under the building.
Yeah, I was going to say one suspects that there was not much land available for surface level parking. Is that correct?
I don't know how much detail I can go into, but we found that in order to meet the requirements of the land use code, we had to provide parking underneath the building. There was surface parking at that site as well.
Okay. All right. Well, that was my assumption. I believe one of the things your testimony, one of the things I appreciated from your testimony is that, anytime you're asked to kind of evaluate another architect's or engineer's project, it's not like you have the luxury of just completely redesigning it. One of the things you said that you thought could occur with the buildings in question on this project is that they could be widened so as to allow the residential floors to be reduced to two stories. Remember testifying to that?
Yes, and I'll point out that the applicant also provided that as at least a site plan indicating that that was a possibility as well.
And I guess, is it fair to say that like any project, there have been any number of iterations of site plans or different building designs that kind of come and go as the permitting process runs its course?
Are you saying in general? Sorry. In general, but I actually haven't seen that on this in materials that have been provided to me. So I can't verify that that's happened on this project.
So do you happen to recall the square footage of each of the floors in these apartment buildings as currently proposed?
For some reason, I was thinking, no, I don't remember. I'm not going to trust my own memory at this point.
It would surprise you if it was on the order of 9,492 square feet per
floor. No, I was going to say 9,000. So
I guess
so that does not surprise me.
And it would be your contention that, at least hypothetically, these buildings could be redesigned so that essentially twice that much square footage would be on each floor of a structure with two floors of residential apartments.
That was the basic idea that you could essentially double the number of units on each floor.
Now, in your, I guess, in that hypothetical, you contemplated that there would also be elevators serving such a building, right?
Well, they wouldn't. Now, see, that's a little bit, perhaps you heard me trying to make a clumsy metaphor yesterday about the tree branch, where if you do double the amount of or increase the number of units in order to bring the building down two stories, you wouldn't necessarily need to provide elevators. So one doesn't lead into the other, right? They're not just linearly lined up.
Well, but you'd agree that it's more just if you had that scenario, again, this is a hypothetical, but where you've got your parking in at least one level of a podium beneath this two-story hypothetical wood frame structure, that it would be desirable to have an elevator to carry people back and forth between the garage and the residential portions of the building, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm. It's desirable, but the whole line of logic that an elevator is necessary in order to bring people out for exiting reasons and so on and so forth, that was, I believe, was being loaded on to the elevator argument by the applicant disappear. There may be other reasons why someone might, why the developer might want to include an elevator in the project.
So I guess as an architect, do you acknowledge that there is that for any building that's designed to be constructed above an aquifer near the surface of the earth, that there has to be accounting for the very real danger of puncturing the aquifer?
Yes.
And as a, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yes, is my answer.
And I guess in your field, can you articulate a factor of safety that an architect would require for a difficult site where there is proposed construction over an aquifer with, again, fairly shallow, that's fairly close to the Earth's surface? I don't know that I articulated that question very well. I'm trying to see if you can articulate a safety factor that applies to this analysis.
Any safety factor of that sort would be given to me by a geotechnical engineer, which I am not.
Okay.
I have shown in the schemes that I developed that I accept the applicant's safety margin and was able to provide options for the design of the building that meet or exceed the safety factor that they have demonstrated, or they at least they depicted in their cross section.
If I was looking at the testimony from the outside, mm-hmm. And being somewhat cynical, I might conclude that the applicants were trying to explain why they would need to excavate so deeply into the ground to establish under building or under structure parking, whereas the appellants were trying to establish just how shallowly they could excavate into the ground to establish under structure parking. Would you concede that if there is a podium style parking structure beneath the rest of the apartment building, that the mere existence of that concrete structure will necessitate deeper foundations, even if you were to establish it as being like the first story of the structure, as you said was a potential or a possibility yesterday?
No, I wouldn't concede that point because it's a three-dimensional problem, as you should appreciate. And there are ways to raise the structure regardless, if you will, of the depth of the foundation that's required for a wood frame building, or the depth of the foundation that's required for the garage. And I also have indicated in my pre-briefing report that there are numerous design strategies that the applicant could avail themselves of, or at least disprove don't work, such as post-tension slab construction, that would actually allow them to effectively thin up their structure, make it less bulky, in order to not make the final size of the structure go any closer to the margin of safety that's established by the geotechnical engineer.
Okay, fair enough. You would agree that ultimately this question is really the domain of the geotechnical engineers and the structural engineers before any such project could be approved, right?
So I don't agree that it's the domain of the geotechnical engineers, because nothing I've said, and I want to just be really clear, I'm not representing that there should be any change in the margin of safety that's been established by the applicant and their engineering team for the geology. So there's no need to speak to the geotechnical engineer, because I am not implying that the building needs to cross over that line that has been established by the applicant and their team. in terms of the structural engineering, it is not the domain solely of a structural engineer. And I could point you to the RCW and say, please read what the RCW says about what the role of architects are. And it includes a fair degree of responsibility for the structure and the assemblies of the building, if you just take the verbiage straight out of the RCW. But let me just be perhaps more illustrative. Structural engineers don't come to my office and tell me, hey, I want to build a building this shape and on this location, and I want it to have, you know, these functional requirements. I go to the structural engineer and say, hey, we're building a building. It needs to be this shape. It needs to have these functional requirements. I usually take a structural system that I have in mind to the structural engineer and say, this is the type of structural system I want to see established in this on this project. I see it as being two levels of concrete, four levels of wood frame, whatever, steel brace frame, et cetera, et cetera. They come and they say, we can make the math work, or we can't make the math work, or we need to sharpen our pencil here, or we need to make adjustments here, or we're too tight there. Fine. I go back. I rejigger my expectations for the structural design. I have a deep understanding of how building structures work because that is my educational background. Take many semesters of structural engineering and then take the structural engineering requirements on my licensing exam. So I fully understand, short of regularly doing the calculus here in my office, because I promised my daughter I will never do calculus for her ever again, because she's four levels of calculus beyond me. Short of doing the calculus, I understand how these structural engineers work. So it is not solely the purview of the structural engineer to talk about the foundation system.
Okay. Well, I think that's a really good and fair clarification. And I can recall from personal experience that the architect has the fundamental idea and then consults with the structural engineer to see if it passes the reality test. So I guess a better framework or a better characterization is that the architect has the essential design, but ultimately it has to pass muster with structural engineer and obtain the engineer's stamp as a general matter.
As a general matter.
Okay. Last question I have for you, speaking of math, is that yesterday you were asked by counsel about the added costs in the instance of $30,000 per stall.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the quick math. We're talking, assuming one stall per residential unit, which means 40 stalls times four buildings, $30,000 times 160 comes out to $4.8 million. Does that sound about right?
I believe somebody else said that, and I'll concede the math.
Someone had said $4 million, and I scratched my head and thought, close, not quite. All right. That's all I had. Thank you. Nice talking with you, Mr. Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Walker.
Thanks, Mr. Walker. All right. Ms. Clungeon, redirect. Dan, you're muted.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm going to have to go back a little bit to yesterday. So we'll start off with I believe it was Mr. Schutz. So he asked you about kind of the cost estimate, and you said you don't prepare them, but you do review them. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay.
For construction costs, you mean?
Right, right. When you review those estimates, do they usually have significantly more detail than the estimates that have been provided by the applicant and their feasibility analysis?
Yes, at a schematic level, which I would still consider this at least the documentation we've seen for this project, I would expect to see a line item estimate of approximately 32 line items with all the various trades plus general conditions, tax, contingency, some fees, et cetera.
Okay.
And contingency being unknowns or areas where there's anticipated risk, cost risk to the project, where the team feels that they need to put some money aside in case for, you know, effectively if the worst happens.
Okay. And then, do you have any more comments regarding kind of the detail that should be provided in a cost estimate?
Well, if you are aware of particular trades or particular aspects of the project that are difficult, a contractor will, or a cost estimator will very often go and get a qualified estimate from a particular subcontractor, or a contractor that it would do, might be the person that would do that work, or the type of person that would do that work. So if you have considerable concerns about grading, you might actually hire a grading contractor or get a favor from a grading contractor to actually give you a hard estimate. Give you a good, a real estimate, for as opposed to them just using historic data that they have from previous projects, or using unit data. Just, we have X number of square feet of tile floors, we're going to just multiply that number by, you know, $6 a square foot.
Okay. All right. And then I want to move on a little bit. There was some discussion about the WGI parking structure outlook that you provided. And I know you provided a link to it in your report, but I mm-hmm. also just wanted to introduce it as an exhibit, because I believe Mr. Schutz, there's been a lot of discussion about it. So I would just like to have that added to the record.
I believe it was Mr. Lin that you're referring to.
Oh, right, Mr. Lin, sorry. Mr. Lin, so I can pull this up on my screen here, but this, let me know when you can see it.
Not yet.
Yeah.
It's coming though.
Okay. All right. Okay. So here is this.
Yes, I see it now.
Of the document that you linked in your report, right?
2024, that appears correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. It said, you know,
no.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Walker.
So I think that would be.
I think it was certainly appropriately illustrative. I would have no objection for that purpose.
Okay. Yeah, she said wants to admit it as an exhibit.
Well, I hear that. I'm not clear on why this is necessarily probative.
Since I guess there's an objection, Ms. Clungeon, I know that the applicant has raised the issue of $60,000 per lot. This is in rebuttal to that. Was that new information that wasn't in the initial exhibit? I can ask Mr. Schutz, I guess. Was that?
The numbers were in the initial exhibit. They were in Mr. Adams' report that we provided, and there was a discussion of this exhibit as well as a link to it in his report. And so I just wanted to introduce the report separately, because at this point, a number of parties have relied on it to make in their analysis. So
yeah, I understand that. But it's since it's not rebutting new information brought up at the hearing and there's an objection, I think I'll have to sustain the objection then.
Okay. So could we have it be illustrative?
It is illustrative, okay, yes.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. In the record. Okay. All right. Do you recall the discussion of this document?
Yes, I believe Mr. Lin was reading to me from this, I don't know what you call it, this sidebar. It's the whole page, the width of the page, this bar of criteria that a garage that has been estimated at over slightly over $30,000, what that garage might look like.
Mm-hmm. And in general, so, and this is PDF page 4, but and then here a PDF or on page 5, here we have that figure that you rely on, this 31,664. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that was the figure I put in my report.
Okay.
And footnoted this PDF.
Right. And that's, it's assuming kind of there's a number of features here. Would you say overall that this project is consistent with some of these requirements or what's baked into this WGI analysis?
Yeah, I mean, the garage that they would provide would have the stalls as being this size typically. I double checked the code. Our code doesn't require stalls larger than this in Silverdale. We all agree that it was going to be a concrete superstructure. Precast would be the choice of the contractor. Precast concrete facade again is choice of the contractor. Like in simple architecture, is all easily achievable here. Glass backed elevators actually sound nicer than I think the elevator the applicant was envisioning. But let's just say that that can be, and the glass curtain wall, that's also quite nice. They actually did not have any enclosure on their stairs. This provides for that. Standard wayfinding is standard, would apply. Shallow strip footings, I contend, is absolutely doable on the site. Above all grade, I contend, because the site is so flat, this is easily achieved and it helps keep us out of the aquifer, in fact. It would be an open parking structure, would not have mechanical ventilation, and minimal or no grade commercial space is true. The and no occupancies above is not true, so that would be an additional cost over and above this estimate. Conventional parking, would that happen? So that would be a deduction in cost because they wouldn't put parking gates on a residential park garage, revenue control system to charge people. And it would have standard LED lighting as required by code. So the over, it's just very close to as good as a close description as you could get, really, in, from a generalized situation to a specific location.
Okay, thank you. All right. And this project, to your knowledge, this project has it already obtained a significant parking reduction? Are you aware?
I'm not going to qualify the significant because I don't know what the numbers were, but I was aware that it received parking reduction, I believe, through a variance process of some sort.
Okay. Regarding, they asked some questions, or Mr. Lin asked some questions about whether you listened to Mike Piowski's testimony and how kind of a small area of deeper excavation, would still concern him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then did you hear his testimony that his opinion is that as long as there's 50% of the confining till, that he didn't think it, he thought it was an acceptable risk to have the foundation at the proposed depth?
Yes, I heard that.
Okay. And have you heard anything about how adding an elevator pit would, whether it would impact that, whether it would go into that 50% confining till layer?
No.
Okay. There was some discussion about the parking structure and how I believe Mr. Lin said it would be elevated a story above ground. Like one of mm-hmm. the options was elevated above ground, but there's also a version that you proposed or that could be feasible where it's mostly the kind of partly underground structure, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And just to alleviate people's concerns, when we say partly underground, there are in the current scheme, in fact, where because the site is so shallow, so flat, they have the building actually currently recessed into the earth a little bit, but they have to build up the earth on the backside so that people can get up to the second floor. So there is backfill envisioned on all of these proposals to quote unquote bury a story. That doesn't mean it's deeper. The earth is actually being built up on top of the existing grade in order to effectually bury the story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I believe, you know, some of the discussion was about how you would see more lights or traffic or something by somehow putting the parking under the structure. Do you recall that?
Yes.
If we were looking at something like this, wouldn't you agree that there'd be less light and kind of car visual impacts for not only the adjacent sites, but also the residents who are living on the site?
Yeah, you would, in this scenario, half the parking garage would be totally shielded 100%. And the other half, with a very short wall in front of the cars, you would shield most of that headlight, at least all of the direct incident mm-hmm. headlight glare. And you would be left with just reflections off the inside surfaces of the parking garage.
All right. Also, do you know, does the parking lot structure for the proposed building, does it include any sort of like illumination or lights around it for safety, kind of parking lot lights, anything like that?
You would have to, and I haven't reviewed the landscaping scheme recently, but you would absolutely have to put light standards. These are going to be tall poles that are going to be at least 15 to 30 feet, depending on their design, with lights on it so that people can safely get from their cars to the buildings, and also to promote a feeling of safety so people feel safe when it's dark outside. Of course, as we all know, it gets dark early here in the fall. So,
okay. So there's a certain amount of light that goes along with surface parking, both from the cars and like parking lot lighting, basically.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
And in
this scenario, all of that lighting that would be necessary for the area that covers 40 cars would be incorporated within the building.
Okay. So if it were in the building, would you agree that there'd be significantly less light impact for the residents and the adjacent neighbors?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I believe Mr. Lin, you went over kind of how there's this four-story walk-up. You know, that it would not be a leasable project. It might exceed what people would pay. And kind of how the economics are a factor in this remand. And I believe your response was that, you know, this feasibility is baked into the cake in the waterfront district. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. And I don't believe you were present earlier. For Mr. Smith's testimony, correct?
No.
Okay. We went over kind of a couple other projects that are in the vicinity that have been permitted by the county. But so we have both the North Beach project that we discussed a little bit, but also the Rivulet apartments. I'll just show you a photo. I showed you a photo during your testimony.
Yes, I remember.
It was small, so I also showed kind of an enlarged version of it here. So let me just pull this up. One moment. And these are also, they're just illustrative. I pulled off of Google, but just to kind of show some examples nearby. Let's see. Let me know when you can see the image.
I can see it now.
Okay, great. So here, pretty kind of, it's relatively close to this project site. It's listed in the feasibility kind of map where it shows that it's just kind of at the, toward the top of Dyes Inlet, kind of along Clear Creek, very short distance away from the, this project. And so here we have, this is a multi-unit apartment building with one level of structured parking underneath, right?
At least one level, like it.
I believe Mr. Smith confirmed that it was one level.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So could, is this an example of how kind of multi-family apartment units with parking under the structure could be, clearly feasible within this area, right?
Yes.
And could something like this be proposed for the Silverdale site or the Silverview site?
Yeah, I in fact, I really like how this garage door is located off the end of the building. So it really maximizes the use of that garage. I think I said that yesterday. It's clearly demonstrates the feasibility of that type of concept.
Mm-hmm. So would the projects like North Beach and this Rivulet that are so close by and kind of similar types of projects, would that demonstrate that this is feasible in this area?
Yeah, especially since I believe this project is further away from the water than the site that we're talking about. The site we're talking about is going to have even better water views. And so, yeah.
And would you say this site might look to have kind of a similar grade to the Silverview site? So relatively flat.
It looks relatively flat, but you have to be careful about reading too much into any of these one shot photographs. I do see some grade creeping up towards the far end of the building there, but it doesn't look particularly sloped.
Okay. And with these, it looks like about two floors or two levels of apartments. Would this likely be a shorter building than what the applicant has proposed for the site?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so would that be more in line with preserving views and compatibility with adjacent with nearby single family use?
I believe it would be, yes.
Okay. Okay, stop that share. Okay, and then I believe Mr. Wachter asked you, he asked you if you would concede that the podium structure that the exists or the structure would necessitate deeper foundations, and you did not agree. You did not concede that point, but I just wanted to kind of elaborate on that. Would you agree that the depth of the foundation may increase with structured parking, but that does not mean that the foundation needs to actually go any deeper?
Yeah, it's probably better to use the word thickness. The thickness of the foundation might increase. Mm-hmm. But again, since it's a three-dimensional problem, you have opportunities both to move the entire building up in space. You also have an opportunity to effectively move it away from the slope in space. So pull it as the slope is going down, pull the building away from the slope horizontally. These are all design solutions that the applicant, I wish they would, I guess since the applicant is the designer and the owner, he's unwilling, even though he's uniquely positioned to be able to redesign the building at his own cost, at minimal cost, he seems unwilling to do that. So.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, who are you referring to?
Mr. McCormick.
And then in the question about the kind of added cost, where if we even do $30,000 per stall, the math coming out to, $4.8 million for 160 units. Is there any in the study that shows what the estimated costs for the project as a whole are, or and how that would compare?
I haven't seen any budget estimates for the project as a whole.
Okay. All right. Okay. And that $30,000, the $30,000, it's your position that does not deduct for some of the costs that are already baked into building on this site, right? Some of the foundation and the retention walls and surface parking and things like that, correct?
Yeah. There are definitely going to be some savings, probably not $30,000 worth. Mm-hmm. But there's some savings that need to be accounted for there's just no analysis of how much the surface stalls cost, how much the waterproofing for human habitation costs on the lower floor, and the additional insulation that's required to accommodate human beings being in that basement floor in the dirt, so to speak. So there's quite a few costs there that would need to be teased out if you were going to do a true apples to apples comparison of costs.
Okay, so some of that $4.8 million might just already be part of the cost of building at the site, right?
Yes, it's clear that every surface stall needs to be accredited against that $4.8 million that is replaced with a garage stall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Is there anything else that you'd like to address or respond to based on Mr. Lin or Mr. Wachter's questions both yesterday and today?
No, I don't have any further questions for anyone.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Adams. It's always very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner.
All right, I guess back to Mr. Schutz then for his rebuttal witnesses.
Examiner, first one would be Mike Miller.
Who is that?
Mike Miller.
Oh, Mr. Miller, okay. All right, Ms. Schlatter, let's bring him up.
Absolutely. Pulling him over now.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but could the appellant's counsel tell us if they anticipate calling any further witnesses? We're trying to plan.
We do not unless we need to for basically rebuttal.
Okay. And more specifically, do you anticipate calling any wetland witnesses for sur rebuttal?
I don't. Are there any other wetlands? I don't think so.
Okay.
I think we might be done with wetlands.
Yeah. Mr. Schutz, you're done checking with wetland experts, right?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to know because people have been listening in and at some point they need to stop and move on.
We are done with wetland experts.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
We're done with wetlands. Great. All right. Let's see. Do we have Mr. Miller up?
Trying to promote him to a panelist right now.
Yeah, I see him up on the panelist list. Just gotta.
So are we at a, are we close to a break?
4 o'clock would be the
break time, yeah.
We want to try to get this done today. We'll see.
Okay.
It's just taking a second. Sorry, everyone. Okay, there we go.
Oops. Okay. Hey, he was unmuted. Now he's muted again. Let's see if we can. There he goes. All right, Mr. Miller, we don't have your video for some reason.
There you go.
Okay, perfect. All right, Mr. Miller, let me swear in again. Just raise your right hand. You swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
I do.
Okay, great. All right, go ahead, Mr. Schutz.
Thank you. Cognizant of the time and that we're trying to wrap up today, I'll try to, I've pared this down some. We'll try to get through this stuff as efficiently as possible. So I don't have too many questions, but I do want to address some of the things that came up in Mr. Adams' testimony, both yesterday and today. So one is that this idea of a balcony, that to address the four flights of stairs issue. You heard him testify about, you know, the quality of housing is important. That's one of the terms that's in the design standards. In your mind, is having a balcony, you know, that's shared motel style, is that quality of housing in your mind?
If you're referring to the idea of connecting stairways, I think he was referring to a different way of exiting apartments and being able to go to two different stairways. No, I don't feel like that provides quality. It's not something that I would propose to any of my clients for this type of housing. I think he referred to the idea that it would only be the kitchen that's looking out on that balcony. And I think that's true of the floor plans. However, most kitchens, and I think you would want this, would have a window over the kitchen sink, and to have people pass by going from, you know, one unit to another, I think would be disconcerting and poor design. He then said, I believe that, well, you could put that windowsill up at like 6 feet, and then that would at least allow daylight to come in. And I have two issues with that. One is that most people's eye level is below 6 feet. So having a window that high would be really a bad design choice. And frankly, you'd have corridor lids above the, you know, if you're walking on one corridor, you're walking under the lid of the next corridor or hallway up above you. So that would preclude any amount of daylight coming into that kitchen. So, you know, generally, I think it would be a poor design choice.
I apologize. I'm pared this down and kind of moving things around. So I might be jumping around.
Fine, don't worry.
For that. I believe Adam said that you should have, you know, the applicant should have full building designs at this stage. The fact that we don't is a fault of the applicant. Do you have a response to that?
Well, yeah. So it's not true that for this exercise that we're looking at for the parking question, underbuilding parking question, we're going through feasibility right now. They do have relatively complete design documents to get to site plan approval for the current design of the project. You know, so in the process of doing feasibility for the parking structure, you would be looking at it in concepts. And, you know, he talked about not having the ability to see, you know, structure or anything like that in our documents. And we do show that in the cross section. And, you know, from my experience, I know that from when I design a parking structure, especially one that might have two levels stacked, one over the other, you're going to have columns that come down at every two or possibly three, but more likely two stalls width. And, you know, so it's just an inherent condition of the parking structure. So, you know, the fact that I've designed 12 or more of these types of parking structures means to me that I understand what's going to be a part of the structure that goes into that. I understand that the building that's above this parking structure would need to have seismic and vertical load transfer out of that building and wind load that he brought up. So, you know, to say that we need to have complete documents and a complete cost estimate for this level of discussion, I think, is erroneous.
There was a couple examples or comparables that they brought up, and just recently, you know, a couple minutes ago, I think they were looking at the Rivulet apartments. Do you know the Rivulet apartments?
I'm familiar with it.
Okay. in your mind, is that a comparable here?
No.
Okay, why not?
It's a relatively flat site. Doesn't have an aquifer underneath it. They don't have enough space on grade to accommodate all the parking that would be required for the 74 or so units that they have. So they only had one choice, and that was to go under building in order to accommodate the zoning code parking requirement.
And it does have a large number of surface parking. I saw a bunch of images, but I didn't see any that showed that large surface parking.
Yeah, well, they maybe picked images that showed the entry, but the one image that was shown, it was looking north, kind of looking at that little piece that came off the east side of the building. If you had turned around and looked to the south, you would see a fairly significant surface parking lot. You know, a surface parking lot. I don't know how, maybe significant's not the right word, but there wasn't enough space because of the buffer and the setback from the creek in order to get parking that they had required for their number of units. So they had to go under building, and that's the only way they could accommodate that number of units. So when they looked at, you know, how many units do you think we can get on this site? And well, you know, it's that balance of saying, okay, well, I can't get them all on the surface, so I guess I'm going to have to put them under building.
And we didn't hear any discussion from Adams or anyone else about how deep they had to dig or the foundations involved or any of that sort of thing.
My belief is that building is one level of underbuilding parking. They don't have an aquifer. They don't probably have a high water table there. They're not in a flood zone that I know of. So,
okay. North Beach was another comparable. And did you listen to Mr. Smith's testimony this morning?
I did.
Okay. So he already raised a number of issues. I think it was apples and oranges is what he said, based on the fact that there's no aquifer underneath, that the fact that it was filled, it was an old industrial site. Is there anything else you would add to that as far as the apple and oranges comparison?
That project asked for an exception to get more units in their building in order to make it pencil, I imagine. By virtue of the fact that they were granted the additional units, which I think is why it went before the hearing examiner, they had to establish additional parking, and it's a very small site. It's 1.3 acres, I believe. And I believe the footprint of the building, although I'm not very familiar with the design of the project, takes up a lot of the site. So they didn't have a choice, just like Rivulet. They had no choice but to put parking under the building in order to accommodate the unit count that makes the project pencil out financially.
Talked about that it's actual waterfront and that
you're breaking up. I'm sorry.
And we already talked about the fact that it's actual waterfront and then could command. And is, do you know if it's condos or rentals?
It is shown to be rental apartments. However, yeah, it's shown in the documents as rental apartments.
Okay. But again, apples and oranges for the aquifer and other reasons.
Yeah, and I'd just like to touch on the waterfront comment. That is a waterfront site, and waterfront sites actually touch water. And I believe Mr. Adams yesterday opined that the Silverview site was quote-unquote a waterfront site because it has proximity to the water, but that's just not true. It's not a waterfront site. It doesn't touch the water. So I decided to take a look at what the tax assessor says about a waterfront site versus a non-waterfront site. And the tax assessor has the North Beach property assessed at $735,000 per acre, you know, for just the tax assessments. And the Silverview site is assessed at $229,000 per acre. So almost two-thirds less. And if the Silverville View site was on the water, if it was down where the houses on Dyes Inlet are, I would imagine that that price would more than triple because of the size of the site and its ability to take a larger project.
Adams talked about elevators. Mr. Adams talked about elevators would only need 4 feet and can get, and you could get some just by asking the elevator company that basically add no fee. Is that true?
Yeah, that is an incorrect statement. And I think he agreed with me that that's not a true statement. He did say that you could, that the elevator companies invite you to call them to discuss the pit of the elevator. So I went ahead and contacted Schindler Elevator Systems in Seattle or wherever their office is, but it's in the Puget Sound region, because that was one of the groups that he said offered that. And they came back with the fact that all of their elevators require a pit, whether they're hydraulic or traction. All commercial elevators have a pit. And I don't know if she was only referring to Schindler or all, but the quote was, all commercial elevators have a pit. All our elevators require a minimum 4'0" pit or larger. There's also another piece to this, and that is with a hydraulic elevator, which is more than likely what you would have in a building like this. The labor and delivery, or labor and delivery, the state would require a sump at the bottom of that pit. And that sump is there to capture any kind of hydraulic fluid leak or the possibility of water that might get into the pit through some other means and pump it out. So, you know, elevators are complicated, as I said, but to opine that you can get by without a pit, the only elevator that I know of that you can have a zero pit or a shallow pit is in a single family home.
Okay. I think one of the, some testimony that Mr. Adams gave was it's not so hard to find an area under the building to put that, that elevator. You could just, you know, till layer thicker and so forth and it, just figure out a spot and it's not a problem. Do you have a response to that?
Well, you're dealing, it's kind of like groping in the dark, right? I mean, you're really relying on the hydrologist. It's not a a geotechnical engineer. And as he was stating earlier, it's the hydrologist report that is significant relative to the aquifer. And the aquifer is a salient issue here. You know, I know that the neighbors are concerned about the aquifer and building, you know, above the aquifer, but you know, to me, you know, if I could use a phrase, it'd be like playing Russian roulette with piercing that aquifer, especially given the fact that we heard a story about from the hydrologist, I think on Monday, about how dreadful a piercing of that aquifer would be. We have buildings in four different locations on this site. And yes, you can move an elevator around. You can design the building, as he said, to decide where you want to put your elevator, where you want to put your lobby and that sort of thing. But you don't know where the lens of water is. You can guess, but if you guess wrong, you've got a problem. And so I think it's an issue. It's a big issue. And I think it's a salient issue that makes putting under building parking in this situation completely infeasible and unpractical in my mind.
You just heard testimony from Mr. Adams talking about the WGI. They pulled it up on to look at. Do you have any response to that?
I do. I think it's, you know, like I said, I've done feasibility studies and strategy studies for clients for the last 40 years. And if I were to propose to my client on this site or another sloping site, and that the cost of doing underbuilding parking was $30,000, and my cost estimator is telling me it's $60,000, then I'm going to have a problem. So I would agree that $30,000 might be appropriate for a project on a flat site without any encumbrances, without any bad soils, without any building above it, open on all four sides. You know, whether it has a glassy elevator or a glassy stairway, you know, that's fine, but it's not going to be $30,000. It's going to be more than $30,000. And another study from White's Construction that I talked about yesterday suggested a range of cost on underbuilding parking of $188 per square foot to $235 a square foot or something like that. That's where I came up, where the $63,000 number came from.
Okay. Did Mr. Adams' own drawings, show above grade parking, the type that's contemplated in WGI? Above or on grade?
You mean the sketches he did for this discussion?
Yeah, the sketches that I saw, I thought that all of them have some, you know, essentially dug into the ground.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're dug into the ground.
Okay. Mr. Adams, we during the redirect, I think Mr. Adams pulled up another drawing with one level of parking that he'd done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That doesn't accommodate all the parking under the building, that one level, right?
Right. That's a good question, because my understanding is, even with the reduction in parking that the county agreed to in lieu of putting parking under the building, according to their documents, and according to the testimony this morning from Mr. Smith, you still have 1.5 cars, or about 60 cars per building. So I wouldn't argue that we can't get, you know, the 40 or maybe 35 or something. Well, maybe not 40, maybe about 32 per floor. So you're still going to have more than one floor of structured parking in order to accommodate the 1.5 cars. There's another 0.5 cars in the zoning code, I believe. So you're actually having to provide two cars per unit. The 0.5 cars is what I believe the hearing examiner was referring to about visitor parking on this site.
So under that, with that drawing, you have two things. You have a structured parking element, and you have surface parking with the lights associated with that.
Yeah, and those, you know, that's a moderate amount of surface parking.
Yeah, okay. I also, in that drawing that we just looked at, the building, I think, was 45 on top, and that's not what it would be, right? 45 wide. I mean, because it shows an elevator going up the middle.
Right, I think that was a depiction that was supposed to be the current building on top of a parking structure.
But it wasn't accurate, right? If it showed an elevator, because it would be much wider with an elevator. Is that right?
So it depends on how the elevator acts. So right now, the access to that four-story project is stairways, as we discussed yesterday or the day before. So I'm not sure how the elevator would access that building. It's not wide enough to get double loaded corridor like we talked about, or like the Rivulet building is.
All right, wrapping up here. We talked about a lot of visual impacts, just came up again on redirect. I think Mr. Adams testified that structured parking, you know, provides visual impact, better visual impacts than surface parking? Do you have a response to that?
Well, it's going to be a parking garage. It's going to look like a parking garage. And the Rivulet building looked like a parking garage under a building. So the aesthetics, you know, are compromised versus what we're proposing right now. I still argue that you're going to have more than one level of parking. You're going to have cars and LED lights within the parking garage. And those LED lights more than likely will go on and off as a sensor goes off when a car is transitioning through the garage. But you still may have car headlights or taillights, you know, transitioning the space and shining out. There was some discussion about surface parking. You know, I think we talked about that. And I believe that the surface parking headlights will be shielded from the neighbors by the landscaping at the perimeter and the landscaping within the field of the parking areas. But there was just a comment about light poles. You know, light poles are an interesting thing, but new code requires in some cases it's code, but light fixtures for parking lots right now have what's called full cutoff fixtures. And those fixtures force light down, not out. They're not those old lights like highway lights that we used to think about. They're LED and they push light down. So that light is not supposed to escape the perimeter of the site. And those poles are probably not 30 feet tall, like I think he testified. He also said 15 feet. I would believe they'd be closer to 15, maybe 18 feet tall. And they're pushing light down, not out. So you're not going to have light going up into the sky or light theoretically escaping the site.
Okay. Getting toward a break, maybe I'll just wrap up. Is there anything else that you know you wanted to discuss about Adam's testimony that I didn't touch on, understanding that we're trying to move through and get done today if possible?
I just have a few comments. They would talk about the Silverdale Design Standard is not seeking inexpensive housing. He talks about quality, and everybody wants quality housing. I believe that. But the comp plan and the Puget Sound Regional Council do talk about inexpensive housing, especially housing that hits the missing middle market. Housing that provides quality housing for people who need jobs at the hospital or need jobs in Silverdale. Housing for people who can walk to the grocery stores and things like that and get services. So I think that's one thing. Here's an interesting thing that he said, and I'm not trying to make people mad here, but he stated that the 6 to 12 foot deeper building disturbance concept was incompetent. And I take issue with that. It's not incompetent, it's prudent. He went on to say that engineers don't seem to care about clearances, and I don't agree with that. The engineers that I work with do care about clearances. They know how space works. And, you know, the engineers I've worked with for over 40 years understand the use of space and what's required to make buildings stand up and to make the seismic forces that move through buildings during an earthquake get safely exited out of that building and into the ground. So we're not incompetent. I think we're prudent and we're good designers and we know what we're doing. The issue of side access versus end access to a parking garage, you know, he commented that on the Rivulet building, and yeah, that's one way to do it. But on a sloping site, you have to create retaining walls in order to get end access. So side access may be the least expensive and most efficient way to do it. So those are a few comments. You know, I don't really have anything else to say, I guess.
Thank you.
Well, I will say that I firmly believe, and I understand this, that the imposition of below building parking with elevators or not, but below building parking with an elevator, because you'd have to have the elevator with the parking, it wouldn't make sense to do that from any kind of point of view, is explicitly infeasible on this site. There are too many risks. Puncturing the aquifer is the greatest risk. Going taller might be a risk, But anyway, it's just there are too many risks to think about putting building parking under this under on this under building parking on this site.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Well, let's take just a quick 10-minute break to 4:10, and then we'll march on through. So we'll see you at 4:10.